I fear not the dark itself, but what may lurk within it. Welcome to Lurk, bringing you creepy, strange, and bone-chilling stories, with your host, Jamie Jackson.
Hey, lurkers, welcome to this week's episode. This week, we are traveling to Wyoming for some crazy UFO stories. Originally, I started looking into a story that was considered a missing 411 story, but it didn't take long to find out that the story I was looking at was way crazier than a mysterious disappearance. And then I found more. I did read a book for research for this episode entitled Alien Abduction of the Wyoming Hunter, First Person Account of Carl Higdon, October 25th, 1974, written by Marjorie Higdon, which is his wife, which you will learn later on in the episode. I will put a link in the show notes for the book. I do not highly recommend reading this book. Just trust that I'm going to give you most of the good bits from the book, with better grammar, punctuation, and prose. So let's get started. A little bit about Wyoming. It is the least populous state, though it is the 10th largest by area. It has the second lowest population density after Alaska. Almost half of the state's land is owned by the federal government, which includes two national parks, Grand Teton and Yellowstone. Back in the day, the Oregon Trail passed through Wyoming. I personally died on the Oregon Trail from dysentery. More than once. If you know, you know. Basically, it's a remote state. According to the odds makers at casino.org, there are 2,854 UFO sightings in Wyoming since 1940. That number was as of August of 2019. Calculating the chance of seeing a UFO in the state at 1 in 20,500. So it's the state where you're most likely to see a UFO. And that is the topic of our episode today, UFOs. We're going to begin with the story of Pat McGuire. McGuire was a cowboy born and raised in Wyoming. He was not a drinker, which I think is an important detail to know. Since 1973, McGuire had seen strange lights in the sky. He reported seeing a flying saucer 300 feet in diameter and 60 feet wide at the center. It had all kinds of different colored lights. He said the object appeared frequently and glows like a harvest moon. It's kind of a hunter vest orange when it's down low. Then when it gets high up, it's a real bright light. The only time Pat McGuire was scared was when he and his brother-in-law saw a hovering craft pick up a calf. He said, "We could hear the calf bawling for quite a while, and when the UFO flew away, the calf was gone. We never did find out where they took it." Just west of Laramie, a 900-pound heifer was found with its reproductive organs, nostrils, lips, and tongue all missing. The cuts seemed to be made by some kind of instrument, and there was no clear cause of death. In 1976, two cows were mutilated on the McGuire farm. Then Pat McGuire and his brother-in-law saw strange lights hovering above a herd of cattle. They heard a cow bawling, and the next day, one cow was missing. That was the end of the cattle mutilations on his ranch. The UFO sightings were so frequent there that they became commonplace. Pat McGuire's wife and eight children confirmed the sightings, as did the couple who lived on the farm, Dan and Ruth Grosser. Ruth Grosser said, "I didn't believe him when Dan and I first moved out there, but when one of the things lands in the field in front of the house or hovers directly overhead, it's hard to ignore. This summer has made a believer out of me." One of the most incredible encounters Pat McGuire experienced dealt with the drilling of a well. McGuire's ranch was 7,200 feet above sea level, and he was told by geologists and drilling companies that there wasn't enough water in the ground for an irrigation well on the property. Still, Pat McGuire insisted he wanted to drill in a specific area, but drill companies refused to drill, saying it was a waste of time. McGuire started making plans to dig the well himself. He got a friend to help him, and he bought a tank engine to pump the water and started drilling. McGuire tapped into an underground river at about 350 feet. His well pumps 8,000 gallons per minute. McGuire's is the only land in the area with enough water for cash farming. Other drillers who have tried hitting the underground river since have failed. Under hypnosis, Pat McGuire reported that he had been taken aboard a craft and was in an oval room, and aliens had telepathically instructed him to begin plans for the well. The aliens were human in appearance, around 6 feet tall and 200 pounds. They had large eyes, thin lips, and they were bald. There was also no bridge on their nose. They were dressed in black with silver buckles with raised stars. He said they weren't necessarily from outer space, but could be from another dimension. He was told that the craft was propelled by a sophisticated magnetic system. If the destination of the vehicle is a distant planet, the magnetic system is simply locked into the planet, and the planet's magnetic pull draws the craft to it at an unimaginable speed. No speed is too great for the craft. It can hover motionless indefinitely or perform impossible maneuvers. I was told they were monitoring my well for some reason. I decided to take a shot at them one time, and they paralyzed me from the neck down until they left. I don't believe I'll try that again, McGuire said. His 10-year-old son said, "The UFOs used to be pretty exciting, especially the first time you see one up close. After that, it's kind of like going to school. Not such a big deal after the first day." Under hypnosis, Pat McGuire recalled being taken aboard the UFOs 16 separate times. Pat McGuire isn't the only person to have UFO encounters, though. In January 1976, a Campbell County sheriff deputy was off duty and headed to Gillette from South Campbell County with his family when he spotted a UFO. It was the size of a semi-truck with rotating lights. The deputy flicked off his lights when he first saw the object hovering in the sky, then he began backing up the car as the thing grew closer. It became whiter in color as he got closer. The deputy backed the car for about a mile, then tried turning around. The object was then about 100 yards away and 10 feet off the ground. It dove down an arroyo into a stand of trees and vanished. The deputy said he and four others at a cluster of ranch buildings where he had just come from piled into a truck and headed for the draw. When they arrived, they spotted a bright light dart swiftly from the draw and disappear. He and the four others thought at first the object might be a jet, but that was discounted when it darted into the trees. It was the first time the deputy had ever seen anything like that before. In 1976, from a dozen Wyoming counties, were reports of cattle mutilations. Ranchers curbed grazing and watched for mysterious lights that were reported, so much the sheriff was also on watch. The genitals and organs were missing from the cattle, along with the lips and sensory organs. There were no bloodstains and no vehicle tracks. Uinta County reported 15 cows mutilated in a 2-week span in October. In October of 1976, another man by the name of Woody Polston had his own UFO encounter. He went to the Norris Geyser Basin in north-central Yellowstone National Park. He selected this area because of the stories of strange lights he had heard from old-timers. Just after sunset, Woody Polston began flashing a message into the sky with his light that said, "Friends, I love you," in Morse code. He used a portable light plugged into the cigarette lighter of his Mustang. He had been there previous nights, repeating the message 100 times. "I do not recommend doing this. Messaging some unknown being that does anal probes, that you love them? Yeah, not a great idea." On this night, Woody Polston saw two distinct objects. He said, one of them went from the east to the west and the other went north-south, sort of in orbit. They were quite visible because they were so big and they had that aluminum cover that would reflect the sun's rays. The first one was a cylindrical thing, kind of a disc. It was followed by another craft that Polston said was at least as big as a Safeway store. He said, the big one came in and it had a formation of some lights around an edge and over the right-hand side. He saw an identification of some kind on the right side of the craft that was like an entrance or a telescope. He could not remember if it made noise. Woody said, I think I looked at it for probably 2 to 3 minutes before I fainted. He snapped a few photos before stumbling back to his car, where he curled up under the steering wheel. He spent the next 12 to 13 hours crouched in his car. He continued his story. I was semi-conscious, but not really. I could feel the car rattling or fluttering from my body pulsations. I know that my teeth chattered so hard that my jaws were sore all the way to the top of my head. When Woody gained consciousness, his watch was 10 hours slow. The next year was a rough one. He didn't share his experience with many people because he was too afraid to talk about it. He would have recurring nightmares and wake up screaming and crying. And that brings us to the account that got me looking into Wyoming in the first place. The story of Carl Higdon. Carl was a 41-year-old foreman of an oil rig who worked 6 days a week to support a family of seven. He was called the Wyoming Coyote because he was feisty and had a determination to get the job done against all odds. He was also an experienced outdoorsman. On October 25, 1974, Carl was on his way to pick up his work crew when he got the call that one of the men was sick and wouldn't be going to work. With a man down, Carl and his crew ended up with the day off, so Carl took advantage of the extra time and decided to head out to do some elk hunting. Carl went back to his house to get his new 7mm mag rifle, then headed out. He planned on heading south towards McCarty Canyon. As he neared the fork in the road heading into McCarty Canyon, he came upon a group of hunters who were working on their pickup truck that had stalled and wouldn't start. Carl stopped to see if he could help them out and get their truck started. As they worked on the truck, they talked about hunting. Carl shared his plan to hunt in McCarty Canyon and see what he found there. The other hunters suggested that the hunting was better in the forest area. Carl and the hunters drank a cup of coffee and got the pickup started. The hunters went on their way, and Carl decided to take their advice and headed to the forest instead of the canyon. The weather was beautiful as Carl drove into the forest. He parked, poured a cup of coffee from his thermos, and got out to stand in front of his truck looking over the area. A game warden drove up, and he and Carl discussed hunting in the area while enjoying some coffee. Carl told the game warden he was going down the hill to see if he could find anything. The warden drove off. Carl put his cup and thermos back in the truck, grabbed his rifle, and walked down the hill along the road. He walked to the left into denser tree cover, then came to a clearing. He stopped and looked around, and he saw five elk standing there. He raised his rifle, sighted one of the elk bulls, and pulled the trigger. But the shot made no sound, and Carl watched as the bullet came out of the rifle barrel, went a few feet, and then stopped midair and dropped to the ground. This all happened in slow motion. A 7mm travels at over 3,600 feet a second, but Carl watched it exit the barrel at slow motion and drop to the ground. And the elk were still standing there motionless. There was no noise in the clearing. Even the birds were silent. Carl walked over to the bullet on the ground and picked it up and put it in his canteen pouch. He sensed something behind him and turned to find a man standing there, though the man was strange. He stood at about 6 feet tall with blonde hair that stood straight up with two strands in the front that looked like antenna. His face seemed to go back into his neck like he had no chin, and it was a yellowish color. He wore a black suit that looked like a wetsuit, and his legs were bowed. The man spoke and asked if Carl was hungry. Carl said he was a little hungry, and a packet of pills appeared and floated over to Carl. The man instructed Carl to take one. Carl does as he's told, though he doesn't really understand why he's doing it. He doesn't really like to take pills of any kind. The man asks Carl if he wants to go with him, and Carl says he does. I mean, the book actually said, Carl says, I might as well. And I'm going to stop here for a second and say that if you're in the woods and a strange man with antenna hair offers you pills and wants you to go with him, the answer is always no. Always. Obviously, Carl never went to the DARE program to learn about taking drugs, and he never learned about stranger danger, because there is nothing stranger than what's going on in the woods right now. The next thing Carl knows is that he's inside some kind of glass cubicle, sitting in a high back seat that he said was like a bucket seat of a car. His arms were strapped down, and there was something on his head, and he wasn't able to move. The five elk that had been in the field were now behind Carl in a cage, and they were motionless. The next thing Carl sees is his truck, as he's looking down on it, as it sits on the knoll where he left it parked. And then, with a wave of the mystery man's hand, the truck disappears. Everything went black, and then there was an intense bright light. Carl could barely open his eyes against the light. There seemed to be some kind of tower where the light was coming from, and below the tower were people. Now there were two beings, and they took Carl down a long hallway into a large room where he seemed to undergo some kind of exam. The beings said that Carl isn't what they want, and that they're going to take him back. They take him back into the light. The light is so intense that it burns his eyes and makes him tear up, and it's unlike anything that he's ever experienced before. He's then inside some kind of craft with only one being at this point, who says his name is Alzo One. Alzo One tells Carl that his kind have been coming to Earth for many years in search of fish and animals. Their food is in the form of pills, and one pill lasts for 3 days. The pills are made of the fish and animals, and that the ocean on their planet is now yellow and all the fish have died. The being named Alzo One continues to tell Carl that his planet is 163,000 light miles from Earth, and that the 9 planets of our solar system supply the magnetic force for the aliens' power. The being takes Carl's rifle and admires it, calling it a primitive weapon, which astonishes Carl because it's a brand new rifle. I don't think that's what I would find astonishing at this point in the story. Alzo also says that they must wear black on Earth because the sun burns them. The craft is now over the forest, and Carl is sent back down to the side of the hill where he slips and falls, hurting his shoulder. Carl doesn't know where he is and has trouble making out the sign that reads North Boundary, Lincoln Forest. He has no clue where that is. He walks down the road to the bottom of a hill. He has no idea where he is. He comes upon a truck. It's his truck, but at the time, he doesn't even recognize his own vehicle. He ends up getting in the truck and uses the two-way radio to try to get help. The person on the other end wants to know who Carl is and where he is. Carl doesn't know either of those questions. He tells the man on the radio what the sign said and that he doesn't know where that's located. He also says he's sitting in a truck with a funny stick in the middle. He meant a stick shift, something that Carl knew how to drive for all of his life. Well, maybe not all of his life, since he had his license. The man on the radio keeps trying to get information from Carl, but all Carl says is, "I don't know, I don't know, I'm so cold." In the meantime, Marjorie, Carl's wife, was growing concerned that her husband hadn't returned from hunting yet at 4 p.m. Her friend assured her that Carl was most likely fine, and that if he had managed to shoot an elk, it would take some time to field dress it and carry it out of the woods. So Marjorie waits. Then around 6:30, she received a call from Carl's friend, Bud, who was asking where Carl was, but Marjorie didn't know. Moments later, Carl's head boss calls looking for Carl. He told Marjorie that they knew Carl went hunting, but they needed to know exactly where, because there was a man on the two-way radio they were pretty sure was Carl, but they needed to find him. And so the search began. The sheriff was able to confirm with the game warden that he had spoken with Carl, which allowed them to narrow the search area. An aerial search was requested, but the pilot had had some alcoholic beverages and was unable to fly. The ground search was organized with experienced hunters with four-wheel drive vehicles. Marjorie and two friends, Don and Marilyn, drove out to the search area to wait for Carl to be found. The searchers' vehicles kept getting stuck in heavy mud and were constantly requiring to be pulled out. As they waited for word, Marjorie, Marilyn, and Don tried to get a little rest as they sat in Don's truck. Marilyn dozed off, then woke with a start, yelling for them to stop shaking the truck. But the truck wasn't moving. Then Marilyn pointed out a strange star that was moving and changing color. Don was dismissive about it, and then at that moment they got word that Carl had been found. When Marjorie got to Carl and tried talking to him, he turned to look at her, but it seemed as though he wasn't seeing her at all, and just looked right through her. She asked him if he had gotten an elk, and he responded by looking through the windshield at the sky, saying, "They took my elk, they took my elk," in a sing-song fashion. Carl was shivering, and when Marjorie went to place her coat over his shoulders, he started yelling, "Don't touch me!" All he could manage to do was stare at the sky, singing, "They took my elk, they took my elk," over and over. Carl was taken to the nearby hospital, and on the way he managed to get out of the vehicle he was in when it stopped. He was screaming, "The lights, oh God, the lights," and it was determined that the headlights were bothering him. They got Carl back to the vehicle and to the hospital. At the hospital, he kept talking about beings and traveling to another planet 163,000 light miles away. He didn't know who he was, and he couldn't recognize his wife. The doctor ordered tests that all came back normal, including a drug screen that proved Carl was not under the influence of drugs or alcohol. He was diagnosed with amnesic shock, and the doctor kept him at the hospital for a few days. While there, he kept complaining about the lights, even though his eyes were closed and at times had a cool compress over them. Marjorie took Carl's clothes home, and as she was putting them away, a mangled piece of metal fell from them. She took it to the sheriff's office, and a deputy identified it as a shell casing, one that looked like it had been turned inside out. Carl's memory finally returns, and he's able to go home. His wife and two children try to get back to a normal life, but Carl is unsure of himself and his sanity. He refuses to drive and does not return to work. He begins having nightmares and he wakes up sweating. It was determined that there was nothing wrong with the rifle, in case you're wondering. At a friend's urging, Carl begins to meet with Dr. Sprinkle. Leo Sprinkle was a psychologist employed by the University of Wyoming who also had an interest in UFOs. Dr. Sprinkle had an artist draw a rendering of the being named Ozo 1 based on Carl's description. This is how Carl described the being. He was 6 feet tall, had no chin, had bowed legs, straw-colored hair with two strands sticking straight up, like antennas. He had no visible ears. He had slanted eyes. His skin coloring is the color of an oriental. The being had two arms, but no hands. The one arm came down, and then nothing. The other arm had a cone-like device on the end of it. Whenever he pointed and waved the cone-shaped device, an item disappears. I don't know where it goes. You just can't see it anymore. He's dressed in black. It looks like what a scuba diver would wear. Carl was tested extensively for mental illness, but was found to have none. he underwent several hypnosis sessions. Prior to the incident, Carl suffered from lung scarring and chronic kidney stones, both of which were cleared up after his disappearance. One night, sometime after the incident, Carl wanted to go for a drive. His son and Marjorie, his wife, went with him. He drove south of town and they saw a green light in the sky, shaped like an upside-down ice cream cone. There was also a horrific sulfur smell in the air. Carl drove to the top of the hill, turned off the car, and said, "I'm late. I was to be here a few minutes earlier." He then got angry and said, "Why am I here? If we had been here on time, what would have happened to us?" They returned home. Several nights later, he was contacted by the beings. They seemed to be letting Carl know that they could contact him whenever they wanted. Carl did return to work, and he ended up retiring from the oil industry in 1997, after 48 years on the job. Over the years, bright lights could be seen following his work truck. It was witnessed by members of his crew as well. Several TV shows featured segments on Carl's story, but all refused to actually go to the area where it happened, saying the area had a strange feeling. When Carl was found, his truck was not in the location where the game warden had talked to him, but was instead stuck in a muddy hole, with no explanation how it got there. The vegetation in the area where he shot at the elk was seared with high heat. Marjorie took the bullet to be photographed, and the place that photographed it burned down. Then the bullet went missing from a university safe, and the Higdons believed their phones were tapped. Carl had some words for others who experienced similar strange things. Talk to someone you trust. Don't dwell on it, and get on with your life. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Remember, you can listen to Lurk wherever you listen to your other favorite podcasts, or at lurkpodcast.com. On the website, we also have links to our social media, so be sure to like or follow us. Don't forget, Lurk will be at the Wytheville, Virginia UFO Festival June 8th and the Sasquatch Saturday in Sykesville, Maryland on June 15th. The links to those events will be in the show notes. If you like what you hear, tell your friends and consider giving us a 5-star review. And until next time, keep lurking.